Mini episode 1627 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Sportsology, delivering unconventional columns and webcasts about sports, TV, music, movies, and more. Follow them on the web at sportsology.com.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to FDH Lounge mini episode 1627. This is FDH managing partner Rick Morris coming at you. And we have with us here today one of our favorite FDH Lounge dignitaries, my great pal, FDH Hoops analyst Ben Chu. We are breaking down the aftermath of the 2023 NBA draft that we had been talking about in weeks leading up to this here. We did our draft lottery recap a couple weeks ago here, that once we knew at that point where Victor Wembanyama was going, that was something that we were talking about. It was a little bit then of the intrigue of is Charlotte really going to be dumb enough to pass on Scoot Henderson at two? And spoiler alert, if you didn't get to catch the draft, they were dumb enough. Charlotte was very Charlotte, as they say. And so Portland gets lucky at three, even if it's not a great fit for that franchise and where they're at right now on their timeline. And again, the unwillingness by both Portland and Dame Lillard to just admit the obvious as far as the conflicting timelines here. We'll talk about all that and much, much more with our good buddy who is up there in the Rose City, Ben Chu. Ben, it's a very, very interesting landscape coming out of the 2023 NBA draft, not least of which because we had a couple of blockbusters leading up to it, a couple of big trades.
Sure. And it was an interesting draft just overall because, obviously, you know, when you have a generational talent like Wembanyama and Henderson's in that area too, it's a very deeper draft than I think initially a lot of us thought. But it's also going to be very interesting to see if this is the top-heavy draft that some analysts think this is, or if there's going to be some real gems in some of these later rounds.
Well, and again, to one of our recurring themes on the show that we've had going back to at least the fall of 2020 when we did a segment about the player development importance in the NBA, because that was the year that Denver and Miami both made it to the conference finals. And that kind of flagged it at our point. It's been on our radar probably even before then. We've been talking about it since then. Denver and Miami in the finals this year just puts more of an emphasis on it, that especially with the new CBA coming in that essentially is going to function as a hard cap, essentially, when you reach that second apron, that filling out these rosters, doing so in the most cost-effective structure, basically, if you want to steal the baseball term of Moneyball, of how you do it the most effectively and balancing out the rosters here, you look at the draft this year, and I think it's going to rise or fall based on that, and particularly in the case of so many of the players, and I think maybe the poster children in this draft for guys not named Victor or Scoot would probably be the Thompson twins, Amen and Auger, because, man, if those guys can learn to shoot, they are going to be unstoppable. And that's really the thing here, the player development that's going to come in with so many players in this draft. And in that sense, it is similar to the last couple of drafts here, because that is a common question mark on a lot of guys, even guys going in the top 10 or in the top 5, as the Thompson twins were, as the case may be. Is the most important skill in today's NBA is learning to shoot consistently and effectively and especially preferably from distance. But that's what this draft is going to rise or fall on, Ben, is how many of these guys get that shot at the pro level and how many of these guys don't. If a bunch of them do, we're going to look back on this as a great draft class. If a bunch of them don't, then we're going to yawn about a lot of the class that doesn't involve Victor and Scoot.
Right, exactly. And I think ultimately the real determining factor is that a lot of the guys at the tail end of the lottery aren't exactly household names to a lot of people. So it's not surprising to me that this was one of those weird drafts where it was leading up to it a two-player race between Wembanyama and Scoot. And that was pretty much everything at that point. But again, there are some other talented guys, including, you know, Derek Lively of Duke. You got Jordan El Shafino. You also got, you know, Jaquez from UCLA, who's also going to be very interesting when he gets to play in Miami. And, you know, there are a lot of guys that will either be will have the opportunity to break a lot of rotations and will have the opportunity to just be good players in today's NBA. But it's going to be, again, like we said, it's going to rise and fall determining on what players get what opportunities.
Absolutely. When you're talking developmental guys and a guy really, really rising up the draft boards quickly here, I think I had him going 13 in my mock draft at fantasydrafthelp.com. And again, go check out Pro Hoops Draftology 2023, available on the main page at fantasydrafthelp.com, our guide to the draft. I think I had Bilal Coulibaly going 13th, and he still managed to go 7th. The fastest rising guy up the boards here. Boy, oh boy, does he owe a lot of money to Victor for putting him over consistently and talking about how everybody should draft him. And again, a guy who's got all the physical tools, a guy from France who comes in pretty raw, and again, it's the whole thing. Man, if this guy can shoot, there's going to be no stopping him. But he comes in probably just about ready-made defensively. He can help in some other ways, secondary playmaking. There's a lot of things that he can do. But again, at the end of the day, it's going to be this guy's ability to score that's going to show whether or not he was justified at going all the way up at number 7.
Right, and the big thing, too, is I think we also tend to forget with European prospects that there's this tendency. We've seen as many success stories, but there's also we've seen a lot of the failures. And essentially, Coulibaly, during the time at Metro 92, he was kind of, if you watched him when he was playing with Victor, and essentially he was kind of the five-tool guy, could make threes, could get to the basket. He's only 18 years old, Rick. So at the end of the day, right, he's a very rough slate. But I would argue that if I'm the Wizards, taking a swing like that, since they're in complete rebuild mode at this point, is not the worst idea. And then you at least have the ability now to kind of see where they want, how they want to remake that team. Because they still got a lot of really good young players on that squad, even with like Corey Kispert and, you know, Abdijah. So it's going to be very interesting to kind of see what the Wizards do, because they'll most likely be having a really terrible season next season. So they're probably going to be in the top three for next year's lottery. So it's interesting to see how a player, it's going to be interesting to see how Coulibaly goes from being a guy who got paired with a generational talent to playing in the NBA. How is he going to be able to adapt? And the second thing I'll also note in that is, will he be able to show some of the flair that he was able to show with this, without Victor on the floor?
Well, yeah, and that's one of those things. I was reading a profile on him, I think it was at NBADraft.net, where they were noting before the draft that this is a guy where if he goes to a team that doesn't necessarily need a lot out of him right away and he can get the time to adjust at a slow rate, it might be better for him. But you're talking about a team like Washington that is now just about without all of its standout players. I mean, you could say they got Poole coming in there. I don't know. A side note about Washington, this is one of these things where, in this way, in the competitive integrity way, this is a thing where I think the NBA right now is doing worse than Major League Baseball circa mid to late 1970s, which is kind of sad because MLB was in a state of complete flux at the time with the new free agency and everything like that. This whole thing, Bowie Kuhn at least told Charlie Finley, you can't just sell players to whatever team you want. This deal of, like, we're going to move Bradley Beal for spare parts, let's just give away Porzingis. This whole thing here, like Adam Silver letting all of this go down, of guys just letting these. I haven't had this feeling about a trade or trades since Pau Gasol went to the Lakers for basically nothing back in the day. And I was like, how did David Stern let this one happen? And then, of course, David Stern subsequently turns thumbs down on the Chris Paul trade, which to me is weird because I thought the Gasol one was even more egregious. But these deals, to me, are pretty egregious. What are you thinking about this and the competitive integrity of the NBA of just giving away star talent?
I mean, it's going, and again, it's one of the things that I think we're going to start to see a lot more of, more than ever now, because of just how, you know, the timelines for a lot of teams are going to vacillate and change. And it was clear that the Wizards had kind of topped out with Beal and Porzingis,
sure.
even though Porzingis had one of his better seasons last year.
Yep.
It just kind of felt like to me that it's a teardown. It happens in sports. You can't really, in terms of competitive balance, it's everyone's against their own sort of, it's essentially a hard soft cap at this point
sure.
in the NBA. So it's really just trying to acquire assets, acquire talent, and try and figure it out. Like, everyone didn't talk about, you know, when the Sam Hinkie was doing the process, like, it was always looked upon as a negative thing, but we've now seen how Philly has improved subsequently from that teardown.
Right.
So I would not be surprised a lot of these teams realize, like, if we're not on the timeline of trying to win a championship, we have to put ourselves onto the timeline. And it kind of felt like that's what Washington is doing. And it's going to be, and I think sometimes too, especially that current Wizards team, if I'm being honest, had really no sort of like game plan or vision, in my opinion. So Michael Winger is going to definitely have his work cut out for him, but he's going to have a blank slate, which is always, I think, a good thing. If I'm an incoming GM or a VP, that's what I want. I at least want to have a clean slate to be able to make the moves to what I think they need to do.
Sure, and that's the thing where, look, I can be very, very pro-teardown. In 2010 and in 2018, as a Cavs fan, both times LeBron peaced out, I was way more pro-teardown than Dan Gilbert was. He had to sort of get one forced on him both times. That is what you have to do, and you're absolutely right that Washington had topped out with that combo right there, and it's pretty sad that with Porzingis having revived his career, Beal the last 2 years has not been as good as the Beal before then, but I'm not ready to say that his best days are behind him. And being in a better situation, I think, is definitely going to help him. Pretty sad that they couldn't be a playoff team either year with those two guys doing what they were doing and respectable to decent pieces from there. My critique of them is, I always talk about, again, whenever you're trading a star player, you try to avoid it, but it might be unavoidable that it's four quarters for a dollar. These deals to me feel like 100 pennies for a dollar. That's where I'm talking about the competitive integrity of it. Like, would it kill you to get something back in return? Would it kill you to make Boston have to pay something to get Porzingis? And don't give me the sob story, but oh, they lost Marcus Smart to Memphis. Oh, they lost a guy who can't shoot, and they're getting in a great shooter in Porzingis. Cry me a river.
I ultimately think the hardest thing to do for any sort of team teardown slash narrative is just also trying to find valid things. And ultimately, if you are a Washington fan, you're going to really see what Jordan Poole is able to do with that team. And then you'll have Kabale. It'll be an intriguing Wizards team, but it's probably no better than 25, 30 wins at best.
Yeah.
So we'll end up seeing what's there. But I think in terms of, if we're going back to your original question, I think these trades are always going to happen. And again, Washington had locked themselves pretty much in the deal, so I'm not really, it's kind of their own doing, so they got the best that they could. So, I mean, ultimately, they traded away one perimeter scorer for another perimeter scorer at the end. There was just a lot of machinations in between.
So. Right. Well, that's true. But as you look at the way that the draft played out here, as far as guys that were falling during the draft here, giving the whole Brady Quinn / Aaron Rodgers award for falling, obviously it goes the biggest one. The biggest plummet, of course, goes to Cam Whitmore, which you and I were talking about as it was happening. To smaller degrees, Grady Dick falling to 13, almost out of the lottery when he was thought to be a top 10 guy for probably much of the draft lead up here. Nick Smith Jr. plummeting all the way to 27, such that I was screaming for the Cavs to trade up and get him. Bryce Sensabaugh falling to 28. That was surprising as well. Chris Murray to 23 to Portland. I think a really good pickup by the Blazers. Something that was like mildly surprising. But again, nobody is going to top the fall of Cam Whitmore going 20 to Houston when there was a thought that he could have gone as high as 4 to Houston.
Right. And, I mean, we see this every year, Rick, and we've always discussed this just in general, that whether it's workouts or demeanor, or it's like, guys, for some reason, don't like guys. And again, we also know, too, Whitmore was dealing with a thumb injury for most of his
right.
time this year at Villanova. So he's a big puzzle piece, in my opinion, for any sort of a championship team, a guy who is pretty tall. I think you can correct me if I'm wrong, like 6'8", 6'9".
Yeah.
And, you know, as a kind of a five-tool player, can rebound, can play good defense, can push up. But we see this every year, Rick, so I don't know why we weren't really surprising. I think it was also more surprising, in my opinion, for Whitmore, just because this wasn't exactly one of those drafts that after you got past the top three that you were like, oh, well, you know, we have to take that guy.
Well,
sort of scenario. So he could have, in an alternate world or a different scenario, he could have gone as high as 4 or 5. But again, the real question ultimately is, he's going to a team with Houston with a lot of young players, all wanting playing time. So it's going to be really interesting to see how he reacts to that and how he deals with a sort of new regime, in a way, with Ime Udoka.
Yeah, and I know a lot of people are thinking that Udoka is going to be the cure-all and help get them into at least some minor semblance of contention. But like you're saying, trying to develop all of these young guys at the same time, you can't do it. I mean, you've got to pick a couple of guys to kind of build around, because they're getting to be like the way Sacramento used to be. For Sacramento, it would always just be this revolving door of young guys they were building around, and next year you slap in another one, and it might be duplicative of guys that you had drafted in the last year or so. And Houston is really starting to approach that point of futility here. For Whitmore, from what I have read post-draft here, a little bit of his workouts were not deemed to be as impressive by some folks here, and then supposedly grading out as far as the personal interviews with teams and everything like that. But that whole thing, and like you said, the combination of the thumb injury, but when you're getting into the whole thing about teams might not have necessarily liked his demeanor, I think that's where we're getting into silly season type stuff. Because the one thing you can say about Villanova players, and it's been key to their success, because they've won 2 national championships well within the last decade and beaten more talented teams on the way to doing that. Villanova is a high character program. We really didn't get any kind of whiff of any concerns about him during the season here. I think there was a lot of overthinking about this young man in that way, Ben.
Yeah, and it would, I mean, and it's a question we're also going to bring up too with Brandon Miller in Charlotte, because he was at least beginning of the year projected to be a top 6 pick, and then pretty much we turned the mock draft enthusiasts and the analysts pretty turned it into Scoot and Victor as 1 and 2, and then the rest of how everything was. And then all of a sudden, once how the lottery shook out with the Hornets picking 2nd, Miller sort of started his incremental rise up the board. And just in general, we both have discussed this on the previous thing. We're both not super big Brandon Miller fans. I think he's, for me, it's just more. Obviously, there's the stuff with the gun situation at Alabama. But also for me, it was just more in terms of his play during the NCAA tournament. He kind of disappeared, honestly, through most of it.
Yeah, I don't...
And I usually like to think, too, and it's kind of weird to say this now, too, Rick, but 6'9", small forwards who can shoot threes and are a little bit athletic, I don't know how much of an impact those guys have on the game anymore, if I'm being honest.
Yeah, I don't know. He just doesn't strike me as being, you know, great enough in any one area that he should go 2nd in the draft. I don't get it. I mean,
yeah.
My analogy
point with him, too, is that his top line is Paul George.
Yeah.
But his bottom line is Derek Williams, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, and it's funny because you and I have been talking about this off air, Derek Williams, the whole thing of, you know, the hype balloon on him in 2011, and me sitting here as a Cavs fan screaming my head off for the team to take Kyrie Irving. And again, there were injury concerns at the time. There would be other concerns that would come along later that none of us knew about. But it's a thing where, at the time, it was so screamingly obvious that Irving should have been the pick. Because I'm looking at Williams, and I had the same feeling about him. He's not a difference maker in any kind of way. And he did get his ring, albeit with the Cavs in 2016, but as a guy that wasn't even in the rotation. And that's the kind of career that he had. Nothing against him personally, but he was not a difference maker. And Brandon Miller, this pick is going to age like milk, basically, as far as how we look back on it. And you know what? It's one of those things where, for Portland, which has had to live with the curse of Sam Bowie over the years, and again, by the way, revisionism on the Greg Oden, Kevin Durant thing at the time, because at the time, there wasn't anybody thinking that Oden wasn't a generational talent at center. So,
oh, yeah, yeah, we'll note that. Yeah,
yeah, but that one went badly as well. For Portland to be on the receiving end of a draft blunder by another team, it feels like cosmic payback. I feel very good for the folks in the Northwest on that one, Ben.
Well, I think also, too, and this is kind of what we talk about. This is the silly season. It's the same thing. I think it's more prevalent at the NFL draft than anything else, Rick.
True.
But it, for the NBA, we have it. And to me, at least visually, watching Scoot Henderson and Brandon Miller play like their best games, it's very clear to me that Scoot Henderson is the better player.
Yes.
And to me, the thing that puzzled me the most was, it wasn't, like, I understand fit. Fit is a thing that GMs, I totally understand, like, Miller fits better. You already have Lonzo, why do you need another guy? That makes sense. I'm not going to rule that out as an analysis point, but I'm always more puzzled by the fact that the entire sort of timeline from when the first mocks were coming out, it was Victor and Scoot 1 and 2 for, like, 3 consecutive months, and all of a sudden when the lottery hits and the Hornets get that pick, Brandon Miller sort of turns into the guy all of a sudden.
Yeah.
And I just, it's an interesting situation for Portland now with Lillard now possibly on the cusp of getting traded out of here, and just how that team's going to really look, because Henderson is probably the most athletic guard we've seen enter the NBA draft since Russell Westbrook.
Yeah. And
so it's going to be, it's interesting to see. They're obviously going to play together. If Lillard is still here or if how everything is. So it's just, it's an interesting scenario because, and we've discussed this off air too, in most drafts, if there wasn't a generational talent like Wembanyama on the board, Scoot would have been an overall number one draft pick easily.
Easily.
It would have easily been like that. But this was the one year that I wasn't saying. It's going to be interesting too because I think also people talk about, and again, look, these are all young players and that, but Scoot's probably, you know, he's been playing pro, even if it is just the G League at 19, he's been playing pro for 2 years, so he has to understand stuff a little bit more, so.
Yes, he does.
No, it's going to be a very interesting situation if Lillard changes his mind and wants to stay. I figure for them, for him specifically, that's probably his perfect sort of running mate because Scoot has the ability to shoot the three, is very athletic, can get to the basket, but that team is known for very well. And having a guy like that, like, I shudder to say that, you know, CJ McCollum is a legendary trailblazer of all time, but the one thing that CJ didn't have is the athletic ability that Scoot Henderson does.
Yeah, and that's the guy you build around, and again, that's the timetable that they ought to be looking at.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see what their ultimate final decision is, and ultimately, it's going to come down to Lillard's decision.
Yeah, and that's where, and again, I think it was Woj who was saying that it's sort of a staring contest between them right now. And the way I look at that is, as I said to you off here, I think Portland should take them off the hook. And they should be the ones to say, hey, look, we don't think we can do justice to this guy on what's left of his prime. We're not going to be able to, our best pieces are so very young that we can't probably put it together. We owe it to him to put him in a situation where he can win a championship because he deserves it, because he's one of the all-time greatest trailblazers. There's a way to do it. Give him what he wants, which is taking him off the hook. There's a way to do it in a classy way. I think they can thread that needle. I think they should thread that needle because, boy, oh, boy, you get a return for Lillard combined with the young pieces they already have and Scoot, and you are well on your way. This may not be a super long rebuild from here, but with the third pick, going there, it was one of those things. What ESPN/ABC did to us, the viewers. Malika Andrews there with. So is Scoot Henderson the definite third pick here? Like a wonderful question. Vapid Zoomer Malika on one channel, screaming A on the other channel. With that crime that Disney foisted on us, Ben Chu, by not putting them on the same channel and letting us avoid that. That was an act of aggression against the American people so great, I think it would even make Bernie Sanders vote for Ron DeSantis.
Oh, that was not needed. That was not needed. But to go back to the original point, it's just more in terms of, if you look at just how sort of the top three sort of played itself out, it's going to be very defining in terms of how that. We haven't really talked about the biggest elephant in the room, which is Victor Wembanyama. going to San Antonio and just how the Spurs are going to build around him. With, you know, they got a lot of young talent there. You got Keldon Johnson, who was on Team USA, and you've also got, you know, you got Trey Jones, you got Jeremy Sochin. So you got a lot of interesting pieces that can help play through Victor. And it's going to be interesting, too, because at least from what I've heard through sources is that they're going to start him at power forward this year.
That makes sense.
So it's going to be very interesting to see how they mix and match guys and pair lineups out. But it's ultimately, I think, Victor's success at the next level will probably just be him staying healthy and just continuing to grow his game. Playmaking, I will say, is the only knock I kind of have on Victor at this point. So if he can sort of, and he doesn't, in my opinion, have to even get to like the Nikola Jokic level of playmaking.
Right, right.
But there's like times you could tell watching some of his Metro 92 games where it kind of isolated himself and me and wasn't actively looking on the floor, you could tell.
Oh, sure. You know, and let's go to the shooting guard position and a couple of additional guys here. Devin Vassell, certainly. And I did see a video recently on YouTube from what I can only call a Malachi Branham truther talking about how this guy is one of the most underrated players in the league right now with what he might be able to do. So if you take that at face value, yeah, I mean, they've got some nice pieces around him. And as we've talked about previously, none of them necessarily your prototypical number two guy on a team that's going to be a contender. I'm not sure any of them profiles as being able to get to that level. I don't know that I rule it out. And again, having a couple of them there all together, you know, you've got at least a 1-in-4 chance, theoretically, of having that most important second piece already on your roster. I think you and I would probably both say, though, the odds favor that piece not being on their roster presently.
Right, and interesting to see with the first, because there is no team that who knows how to draft and develop a center like sure. San Antonio does.
That's right.
So it's going to be very interesting to see what their pattern is, because overall, I mean, we discussed this, Rick, we've never seen a 7'5 center who has good athletic ability and can shoot the three with any level of consistency.
Well,
and it's going to be very interesting to see, like, who you build with around Victor and the pieces they already have. How good is the Spurs team going to get? Because at least for the first, I would say, 2 to 3 years, they're going to be essentially looking down. They're looking up at the Denver Nuggets. But if Victor reaches his potential year two, year three, I mean, you're looking at a guy who could be an MVP candidate consistently and probably an NBA champion probably before he even turns 30.
Well, and on that very subject with Victor, there was a little mini discussion last night on Facebook with a couple of our fellow Sports Talk Network alums, FDH senior editor Jason Jones, and also our friend Don Pizzle, Don Peterson. And we were kind of talking about that in Victor's frame and the whole thing of, like, you have to find the sweet spot here because he's got to bulk up. But it's a thing where you do reach a point. I mean, good old Malcolm Gladwell would definitely say there's a tipping point here, because every pound that this guy puts on, especially past a certain point, it increases the chances of something happening with his legs or with his feet. And already the playing style and doing all of the kind of, you know, wild playmaking that he does all over the court of where, you know, even that particular style, it's a thing where this is a guy where, by far, the biggest threat to this guy's chances of being a top 10 player of all time is injuries. Because this is a thing where if you can look at it and you can say this guy is going to have the health of LeBron over the course of his career, I think a lot of us would pencil him in as a top 10, top 15 player of all time, given what he can do. It's the lower body and what could go wrong, as it does for a lot of big guys, that could get in the way for him here. So as far as the playing style that he does, he may have to tone down some of the stuff that he did in France with a lot of the running around and, you know, the things of, like, take a three and then book in to make the dunk if you miss it, that kind of stuff, and then also how much he bulks up. These are going to be the considerations going forward because, man, if you keep this guy in one piece, no stopping him here. We're not saying anything original in that regard. Everybody talks about how great he is, but there's literally never been anybody like him ever.
Right, and that's what makes it interesting to me, because we always discuss this in the NBA. Usually, in most cases need two superstars to win. Or right. Like what we argue, Rick, like two top 50 players in the league.
Right.
To win a title in most cases. At least two.
Sure.
It's going to be interesting who his perfect partner is like. Is it like a guard who's like flexy and can run around and dunk and be athletic? Or is it more of a guy who's a spot-up shooter, kind of like a Chris Middleton, who can get you 20 or 30 a night while Victor does hit, you know, does what needs to be done in the paint or from three. So it's going to be very interesting to see kind of who his kind of partner is, because we discussed this too, and to go back to the Nuggets again, we saw what they were like when it was just Nikola Jokic himself, and now when you have a healthy Jamal Murray with him.
Right.
Yeah, so it's going to be very interesting. Could it be Kelvin Johnson? Could it be, you know, Branham? Could it be Trey Jones? We'll see. But I would not be surprised, Rick, if we see a mid-tier NBA player make the move to San Antonio with the thought of multiple rings coming their way.
I completely believe that. Again, gun to my head, I'm going to say that player, the number two guy on this team when they're winning titles, is not on the roster yet. That's just my best guess. That would be an interesting Vegas bet if you could make that anywhere.
Kelvin right now, I'd argue, is the closest.
Yes.
But we've also seen periods of time from Kelvin Johnson's career where he kind of just has average games.
Right. What about Branham with his upside? Do you give any credence to that YouTuber?
I think he might have some credence if he can go, but the real question is that then pretty much Devin Vassell is getting most of the playing time right now.
Yes.
So we'll see. I don't know. I would tend to agree with you too, Rick, that I don't think Victor's, you know, co-star is there yet. But we'll see, because there's definitely going to be opportunities for San Antonio to maybe get, you know, a late lottery pick who could turn out to be his perfect partner.
And I'm not sure that there's ever been a case like this, but the way that Bill Simmons does it every year with the league pass rankings, I mean, I think spots 1 through 29 on that would be San Antonio, right? If you're not watching your own team on a given night, is there going to be a more intriguing team to watch night to night than San Antonio and what they're going to be with this guy in year one? It's going to be utterly intriguing.
I mean, we've said this too, Rick. He's the most hyped prospect since LeBron.
Yeah, yeah. And, and by the way, you've just provided me the perfect segue. The Cavs are 1-for-1 previously as far as drafting prep players who'd been on the cover of Sports Illustrated. They went to make it 2-for-2 last night, 20 years after LeBron, with the pick, albeit this was number 49. And the funny thing is, they were pegged to take this guy all along the same way that they were with LeBron 20 years ago, but they had to wait for 48 other teams to pass on good old E. Bates there at number 49. Prep star falling on hard times here, got the gun charges, underachievement in college, yada, yada, yada. But a guy that, as I always talk about, being a pedigree kind of a guy, and somebody who, again, 2 years ago, you would have said this guy goes no lower than third or fourth in the draft. That's a guy that still possesses the same kind of upside, better shooting than so many of the guys that went ahead of him. I know there's the obvious gun joke there, but still. And it's a thing where this is perfect. The enthusiasm that I have as a lifelong Cavs fan, going forward, looking at the new CBA, is, again, these guys that are the you know, jewels in the rough, or whatever you want to call it here, they're, you know, rough gems, that if you can get somebody like that and you can lock them in on the cheap, at least on a rookie deal, I mean, if this guy proves to be a great player, he's going to cost you more on the second one and quicker because he's a second-round pick, but still. The ability to do that, to round out your roster, especially when it looks like the Cavs are going to have three Supermax players in the years to come, that's what's going to price Jared Allen out of town once that happens. So getting impact players in cheap, even getting rotation players in cheap, is going to be paramount for everybody. And it goes back to those same two words, player development. The Cavs are not on the same level as Denver or Miami or what San Antonio has been historically, but they haven't been bad at player development in recent years. I'd argue that they've been above average when you mentioned to me today off air about Lamar Stevens re-signing with them. He, I think, is a player development success story as a guy who's a legitimate rotation player who they got really on the cheap previously. So if they can do that with Bates, it is going to be the home run swing of this draft relative to where they were making the pick.
Right, and if we're going to stay on the second round pick sort of narrative too, some other guys who dropped who I was intrigued by, I mean, the one that just came on the tail end, the James Nagy going to Detroit, played really well at FC Barcelona. I mean, if you're looking at some of these other names too, you also will have Amari Bailey and Tristan Vucevic and, you know, Ryan Rupert from France as well, and Sissoko also. I mean, there's a lot of interesting guys too, and it's going to be interesting to see if some of these later picks, guys like, you know, Isaiah Wong and Jalen Clark and Keonta Johnson, how they're second round careers are going to go, because I think and we've discussed this in countless podcasts, Rick, that this is the one point in the league where you have to be deep and talented at the same point.
Yes.
You have to be. You cannot exist in today's NBA with just, this isn't the late 90s NBA where you can have two guys score over 30 and instantly win every basketball game every time.
Yeah, and in this evolving league, it's funny because a couple weeks back, I was at a cookout with some friends of mine, and these are guys that are not as big of basketball fans. They've kind of eroded over the years because they like to do the old man shaking his fist at the cloud kind of thing. I miss when you knew who the guys in the draft were, and you saw them in college, and they came out there. Now you got these guys coming from like this overtime elite in Europe, and how good are these guys really? Well, the funny thing is, the guy who's the poster child for the kind of guy that they would have hung their hat on previously, Oscar Schwebe, doesn't even get drafted here. Now, that is something that I find interesting because you look at it, and I look at that guy. I mean, nobody is going to talk about this guy's ceiling, obviously. But in this kind of a league now where, like I said, the ability to fill out a rotation on the cheap is going to be more and more important, I look at that guy as having a high floor. And that's a thing where I just, to be like a guy at the end of your rotation to come in and do some of the dirty work and get you some boards and things like that, it's fascinating to me. Now, again, there were guys in the second round, and again, I don't mean to contradict myself because I am a fan of doing things like taking Bates at 49, and there were a lot of teams taking swings on guys in the second round and going for upside. But I think there is room at the same time. I don't think it's a contradiction to say that you also ought to be in the mode of looking for guys with a high floor, and I think not enough teams were, and that's how he slipped through.
Right, and also I know, too, especially in a draft like this that has, like, three marquee names, that guys who normally would have gone higher in drafts, like Strother, who went to Denver, and Jairus Walker, who went to Indiana, who were very good players in college, who had good runs during the NCAA tournament. Sasser from Houston's also another big name, too, that you don't really know where they're going to be in terms of star talent, but they also have the ability to contribute and make big plays. And like we said, filling out rotations and getting, especially with the cap and the aprons attached to the new cap, and the new CBA, it's going to be very interesting that these sort of, in the prior years, Rick, I would say like picks 20 to 40 were mostly forgotten about in most cases.
Sure.
And now you're in a timeline where if you make the right decision and you get a rotation guy,
yeah,
then you're essentially saving yourselves infinitesimal amounts of money at that point.
Yeah, and that's the thing here too, is that this was the first draft with the new CBA looming here. And maybe teams didn't have an ability to sort of pivot because this just kind of came into being in the spring. And again, this is a 12-month-a-year process for teams getting ready for the draft. It will be interesting to see a year down the road how teams approach this here and if they are looking at, because, I mean, look, I think you always should have been looking at, because there always has been a salary cap, at least the last several decades, and a more restrictive one since the lockout of 99, in terms of trying to build a team cost-effectively. I mean, now it's an absolute must because, again, I agree with the conventional wisdom that the second apron basically constitutes a hard cap. But, I mean, anytime you have a second-round pick, the way the teams have sold them in recent years, I've been a fan of Dan Gilbert when he's I've been able to do that and go in and buy second round picks, but I've never understood the whole notion of like selling second round picks and the notion that some teams had that they were meaningless or worthless, because I now more than ever, but I think even before then, there have always been opportunities to round out your rotation in there. The average team, let's say, has nine guys, or I think probably should have nine guys in a rotation. Teams that like to go eight, like the Cavs did sometimes, I think it's too restrictive. There ought to be nine guys on your roster in particular that you really place a value on. And getting one of those guys in the second round, I don't know where people thought it was like scratching off lottery tickets to do that. The ability to locate these guys has always been there. Yes, a guy like Jokic is once in a millennium as far as being able to get a guy who becomes the best pick in the draft late in the second round. That's not going to happen, generally speaking. But getting guys who could be useful contributors, it's weird to me that some teams seem to just be waking up to that now.
Yeah,
and it's puzzling. But again, what I'm going to say with Denver winning the championship this year and just seeing how they build their roster, and then we mentioned Miami is another good case in bringing up young and bringing talent up. It's going to be really, you're going to see teams change their mind a little bit in terms of how they build their rosters and how they acquire players. Because I think in the old, and we would make this argument on the old CBA, it was really about when the rich would continue to get richer.
Yeah.
And now with this more restrictive one, it's going to be very interesting to see how, you know, how teams treat these second round picks or treat, you know, camp invites and treat all that, because I think we're going to see roster construction at the tail end of every roster, like the 10th, 11th, 12th guys, be sort of got these salary fillers or guys who were second round draft picks so that teams can save money to pay towards their stars or their premier talent.
You know, I'm getting a thought here in real time that I'm going to put out there is that I think what could make an interesting segment here to do subsequently is if we get Russ Cohen on with us here, our beloved FDH Lounge dignitary and Sportsology proprietor, because it's reminding me of what happened with the NHL when they went to the hard cap, because they went right from basically open season to when my Red Wings were pretty dominant and just going out and getting whoever we wanted to a hard cap, and he can probably speak to that even better than I can as far as the ways that the NHL has had to adjust over the period of time and player development, how much more paramount that's been and specific things they've done. That could be very interesting for me and you to pick his brain as far as what we can look forward to in the NBA, because you may have a number of teams that are actually looking in that direction and saying, this happened in another sport. They got to this kind of point here. How did the teams adjust? And I think, Ben, that might be the great untold story of the 2020s looking ahead, is how they learned the lessons from other sports and how they've had to adjust with a hard cap being in there, which we know that this is going to be.
Right, and in my opinion, too, Rick, this is going to make the G League even more important.
Yes.
For teams, because trying to get, I think, unless I'm mistaken, now we're almost officially now 30 for 30.
Yes, I think so.
With each NBA team now having their, I think it's either Phoenix or Denver might be the last one now.
Yes, I believe that is the case.
So we're almost at 30 for 30. Well, you know that's going to happen. It's going to be, we're going to see these sort of, again, very similar to Major League Baseball, these farm system teams, essentially.
Yes.
For the G League teams, for your team, essentially building these sort of players up and getting them ready to get into the rotation. And we've seen it, too, like over the last 3 years, former G Leaguers in the NBA have made huge impacts. And I think what we're going to see now is teams are going to be using these camp invites and second-round picks and using their G League teams to essentially help round out their squad, because it's not going to be as easy as buying out, waiting for a team to stink, and then buying out their next guy. So it's going to be a lot more cost-efficient in a lot of terms of how each team is going to impact the other.
See, that's a great thought, Ben, because my first thought went to the NHL, and I think there's going to be comparisons in the time ahead, but you making the comparison to Major League Baseball, I think, is equally spot on. So this could be something for us to investigate going forward, is how the NBA is going to adapt the way the other leagues have, because that's a thing in looking at that where, and let's go even deeper in the weeds here on this, because I remember during the second LeBron era in Cleveland when the Cavs were winning all those Eastern Conference championships and, oh, by the way, an NBA championship in the mix as well here, that what they did with some of their second-round picks and some of the players that they were able to get that were kind of on the fringes. And that was a thing where, and I'm not remembering any specific names, but I'm remembering guys who really kind of dominated in summer ball and then played very well for the G League. They would have guys that could go out there and score 30 points a game in some of these settings, but they turned out to be useless to the Cavs because they would call them up and the usage rate would just be like nothing. Like, these would be guys that would be getting, you know, maybe a handful of minutes a game. It wasn't their job to jack up shots with the Cavs the way that it was with the Charge or in summer ball. So I wonder if there's not going to be more of an emphasis, instead of the way that it's traditionally been with the G League, right? Just let the best players on the team do what they're going to do, of maybe trying to coordinate the skill sets more so to what they're going to be at the pro level. Like, if you're going to be a role player for the Cavs or for the Sixers or for the Clippers or whoever, try and get somebody to be a top-level role player in the G League and try and condition them to fill exactly the kind of spot they're going to fill in the NBA. I wonder if you're not going
to
see more.
And the analogy, too, is that when you go, when each team has their own G League team,
yeah,
you're going to be seeing, and this was discussed, too, because Portland is getting their first G League team, essentially. And it's a big deal because you're allowed then to create a culture and teach guys on that level.
Yes.
What the NBA squad has. So it's going to be very interesting to see how teams are going to, because we've never, at least in this timeline, Rick, ever had a 30 for 30. So each team is associated with each team.
Yep.
In years past, you could see teams who used that very efficiently, but then there were times when they didn't use it efficiently at all. And essentially, there were situations where some players in the G League who were going to teams who were assigned to multiple teams, and they constantly complained that they didn't know. They were just playing, essentially, because there was no distinct brand, essentially.
Right.
But now with almost every team, or possibly every team now having their own sort of farm system, it's going to be very interesting to see how they sort of imprint their culture or their things that they focus on to become a winner more, or in terms of how you build certain guys into the roles that they can be. So that provides a unique opportunity for a lot of these G League teams to not only build competitive rosters at the pro level, but to also find a way into creating more culture for just players at the end of the day.
Well, and again, it's a copycat league. I mean, every league's a copycat league, really. Yes, that's a big cliche, but still. And you look at it here, and this is a thing where something that I have been studying over a period of time as well. That Miami with, I think it, what is it, their Sioux City affiliate in the G League? I think Sioux City is their affiliate. But they've been trying to implement, as much as everybody talks about heat culture and all of that kind of stuff, there really is something to it. And getting players ready to play in that system with that kind of a mindset, whatever. Miami's already been implementing that at the G League level to an explicit degree. And that is something where, again, I think you're going to see so many more teams out there trying to do this. It's funny because, again, sometimes it takes a while for reputations to fade. So it may take a couple more years before people really realize it. And look, the G League or developmental, whatever the hell you want to call it, it hasn't really mattered as much until recent years. And until, again, the NBA has put more of, I think, an investment in a development of it, and it's meant more in recent years. But historically, and particularly in terms of public perception, it hasn't meant a whole lot. But for basketball to get to the level, like you said, you know, with baseball, it's multiple levels of minor leagues. That won't be the case here because it's less players in the game. But it's a thing where having a legitimate minor league system that's there for developmental purposes, where things might happen that can impact actual championships down the road, this is going to be a new and exciting thing for the NBA, for the G League to really matter to that degree.
Right, and I think one of the big struggles that the G League has had is just trying to make these games matter sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of feel like, too, if you now have the... It's going to turn into, in most cases, not all cases, because we know this too, Rick, some teams are super far away from their host city's team. Well, not host city, but their... You know, the team that they're affiliated with. So,
right. The
G League, in terms of how their growth is, and I think they've done a fantastic job under Commissioner Sharif Abdul-Rahim,
mm-hmm.
is just essentially growing the game growing the G League into what it's essentially become, which is the developmental league and allowing guys opportunities. And a lot of the stuff, if we're going to be brutally honest, what we're seeing now in today's NBA was coming out from coaching from the G League, essentially.
Yes, yes.
So it's very interesting to see what that's ultimately going to turn into. And I think the biggest thing for the G League is that if essentially you have a G League team for all teams now, you're going to have full-blown basketball heads who love watching their favorite team, but will also watch G League games to see some of the guys that are going to be some of the up-and-comers for the league, too. So it's, so far, at least when it was the D League, it was essentially just viewed as a developmental league that was just trying to get footing and to help talent. But now it's, if you're going a full sort of baseball farm system at that point, it's a completely different scenario, in my opinion.
Yeah, and again, I think it's going to lead to a better product on the floor at the end of the day here. So there are all these unintended consequences of this deal. And I will just say this, that this is one of these things where sometimes it's the people that don't follow basketball to as intensive a degree as you and I do that can sometimes ask the best questions. But the father of FDH Lounge dignitaries, Anthony Petrone and Matt Petrone, Anthony was explaining this to their dad as far as the new CBA and everything that's in it. And his question to him was, why would the players have ever signed this? And you know what? And Mr. Petrone, I wish we had an answer to that question, because it's one of those things where I think at the time the conventional wisdom was, well, this is really going to bust up Golden State because they've been the ones out there that have been the biggest violators, the furthest over the luxury tax line, et cetera, et cetera. But the degree to which it was going to affect everybody, and ironically even lock in the potential dynasty of Denver, who has all their pieces in place and doesn't need any help going forward here, this is one of those things where we're going to look back on this in the time to come, and we may say, hey, this led to the golden era of player development in the NBA. It was necessitated because of teams having scarce resources once the megastars were being paid. But we're also equally going to be asking, why in God's name would the players have ever agreed to this?
It's going to be one of those questions that is asked for, but as we all know, too, Rick, with expansion on the horizon, the coffers will be refilled with a bunch of money again very soon.
They will, and the one thing I've been saying to people in recent days here, a sense of optimism for me as a Cavs fan, is by the time that the Cavs are paying the three mega salaries here, I think the cap is going to be substantially higher than it is right now. Then again, that might lead to the individual maxes being more. Hopefully that doesn't all even out, but the new TV deals coming in, whether it's Warner Brothers Discovery and ESPN again, you've been talking about off-air that there's probably going to be a streaming component maybe on Monday nights. I agree with you. I think there's going to be that. There's going to be a lot more money at the end of the day. We know this, and that might be an evening out factor in this. But then again, if the salaries are going up at the same rate that the cap's going up, I'm not sure that's necessarily going to provide relief to anybody. Although, again, I guess the key for the Cavs would be lock in these guys before it gets to the rates, you know, before the thing is really, really rising up. Because I guess it's going to be a matter of timing the next couple of years, right? If you can get your guys locked in before the cap really, really pushes higher, then the timing on that could save you vis-a-vis the second apron.
Right, and I think at the end of the day, too, Rick, just in terms of the new CBA, is you're going to see a lot more teams going to be more cost-effective and making sure, because essentially a lot of the bigger, and we all know these two, the marquee squads can buy, were just essentially buying any buyout that they could.
Yep.
And now you're going to see a lot of teams have a lot more purpose in terms of their free agency decisions, and we might see more second-rounders playing the NBA more than ever now, because if you can get a guy locked into a cheap 3-year, 4-year deal to be the 10th or 11th man on your roster, then you're saving exponential amounts of money.
Yep. Oh, yeah. It's the money ball era coming up. Bye-bye fat, hello efficiency, up and down the roster if you want to be a contender, no matter your star power at the top. And, yeah, that's even going to include San Antonio once good old Victor gets to be at the level we know he's going to. But an exciting period of time coming up in the NBA, and one that is going to be fueled by Victor, Scoot, and however many of the other guys from the 2023 NBA draft. A pleasure breaking it down with you as always, Ben Chu. Thank you so much.
I appreciate it, Rick.
Thanks, buddy, and thank you all for checking out FDH Lounge Mini Episode 1627.